The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back as we head into Hour 2, Friday, September 18th, 2020. Open lines Friday, 602-508-0960. Anything that's on your mind? And we'll start with Rich in Scottsdale. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Seth. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I wanted to comment about Christopher Wray's comments, I believe it was yesterday.
Yes, that's right.
About conservatives and, you know, white supremacists being the major group that's causing all of the rioting and the damage to, in these BLM riots in the cities that are burning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's absurd. I've heard, you know, a little here or there about that, but now he's saying that they're the major people causing the destruction. And one thing I always thought is that he was working against us because he kind of slow walking all these documents and protecting the FBI and not letting the truth out. And I think that President Trump should consider firing him and maybe putting in Rick Grenell, or, you know, icing on the cake would be giving Michael Flynn a pardon and putting him as the head of the FBI and let him get some revenge.
Don't you think Rick Grenell would just be fantastic?
Yeah. I mean, look at what he did, you know, in the temporary position he was in. And, you know, I don't know that he's qualified, but I imagine he would be. You know, he was an ambassador to Germany, so obviously CIA and whatever.
Yeah, no, I think someone like Rick Grenell would be great. But there's a lot, and I think you're right that Chris Wray's days are numbered. It has been leaked that the administration is looking for a replacement. And it was interesting the way Christopher Wray said it too yesterday. He was kind of trying to be a little bit more careful than the committee he was in front of wanted him to be, because he started off by talking about racially motivated violent extremism. And then he was pressed on whether it was from the right or whether from the left. And he made this statement about how we don't really quantify the ideology, which I think is nonsense. But it was clearly him trying to kind of, as you say, slow play the effect of what his statement said. Look, whatever the domestic violence case may be in America, we know what it has been mostly for the past 5 months. We know that the 141 cities that have had riots and that have been burnt and that have led to the killings of over 30 people, we know what that is about, and we know what that is from. And one of the interesting things is, I mean, when we play these games, he did say that Antifa is a real thing. It's not a myth, which was a kind of a jab at Jerry Nadler. But one of the interesting things about it, when you look at the news coverage of a lot of these riots, it's an awful lot of what looked to me like Caucasians engaging in them. Caucasians engaging in the rioting in the name of Antifa and BLM. It is left wing, to be sure. It may be more Caucasian than not. It may be. It shouldn't excuse it one way or the other. But I don't think we can hang the violence we've seen with any degree of credibility that passes any kind of sniff, much less smell, much less laugh test on the right.
Well, you know, I think it was Barr that said they arrested, over 1,000 protesters that were causing violence and damage.
Yeah.
So by now, you would think they would know where these people are coming from and, you know, be able to look on their Facebook and Twitter and wherever and see who they're talking about. And if they're Antifa or if they're, you know, right-wingers, you would think they would know who the enemy is.
Yeah, yes, you would. And that's the problem with some of these that's the problem with some of these administration officials. Look, we have the problem at a lot of levels of government. It's just that this one happens to kind of pull at our nerves a little bit more than others right now. But it is amazing how hard it is to get certain forms of data that you would think in this day and age we would be it would be much easier to get. So we are told that there are increases in substance abuse. We are told there are increases in suicides due to the isolation and the depression and the mental health fallouts from COVID. But we can't get hard numbers for another 6 months, we're told. Why is that? I mean, we should, at all these things, whether it's crime, whether it's the ideological motivation behind the crime, whether it's statistics that we should be able to, obtain on deaths and drug use, we should be able to do this much, much, much better. And we just don't. It's kind of what makes me snicker when I hear Joe Biden bragging about the data. He doesn't have any access to data.
And he doesn't give you any.
No.
He
says, I'm not making this up, as he's making it up. Each and every COVID death could have been stopped.
Yeah.
Each and every one. Each and every one, Rich.
Yeah, every one. Did you see where Newt Gingrich was on Fox and they shut him down because he said that the money is coming from Soros?
I spent a lot of time on this one, the other day. It was about two days ago, I think it was on Wednesday. I saw it happen live. I played the audio on this show, Rich, because I don't often have the TV on, but I was doing some work, and the TV was on in the background. And, you know, this is kind of a fun game to play. If there's someone on a news show, CNN, MSC, NBC, PBS, C-SPAN, you name it, Fox, who do you stop? My producer and I play this game once in a while. Who do you stop flicking the channel? Who do you stop switching the channels on? Who do you want to hear out, right? Who do you always find interesting if you by chance see him or her on television? And one of those people for me is Newt Gingrich. So he was a guest on the show, and because he says interesting things. I don't always agree with him, and you know, he has 100 ideas. Two are good, as a friend of mine said. The problem is you just never know which two, so you have to listen to all of them. But he's an interesting guy. He's a deep thinker and an interesting pedigree, history professor and all that. So I was listening to Newt, and I saw him say the most anodyne of things that I thought, the most innocent of things that the New York Times had reported on 2 months ago. There was a headline in the New York Times that George Soros was putting over $200 million into these protests. And Newt Gingrich merely made mention of it for those that aren't familiar with this. Right, Rich? You tell me if I'm getting the story wrong. And Melissa Francis says, I wish you didn't bring up George Soros. And Newt Gingrich said, why not? He's paying for it. And someone else, Maria Harf, I think, the Democrat, said, yeah, you don't need to bring up Soros. And then there was this really weird, awkward silence. And he said, I guess it's verboten. Then the funny thing about all of this was, Rich, that the next day, Harris Faulkner apologized for this. She was hosting the show or moderating the show, but she wasn't who silenced Gingrich. But she was silenced herself. She was kind of, I think she was trying to figure out why Melissa Francis would tell Gingrich he couldn't mention Soros. And it turned out this huge amount of fallout, I had Rio Boy on the show to talk about it, came as a result, saying it's to engage in anti-Semitism to invoke the name George Soros or to blame George Soros for anything. Well, at this point, that is the most absurd way to shut down any criticism of George Soros. Merely saying, no, I get tired of saying it, Rich. The audience may be tired of saying it, but I'll tell you, I've been criticizing George Soros for years. I only learned like 3 years ago he was Jewish. I didn't even know he was Jewish. And I don't even think he is, actually. He doesn't identify as Jewish. He will say he was born Jewish. I don't think anyone thinks Soros and Jewish. I think they think Soros and left-wing and possibly evil. But if the Soros family wants to be able to operate with their billions of dollars in funding extremist organizations in this country and organizations and movements inimical to our civility, they better be prepared for some pushback and some criticism, and they don't get to hold up and wave the label of unctuous servitude like anti-Semitism. They just don't get to. I'm sorry. If we're criticizing Jews, fine. But if we're criticizing Soros, that's a different thing. If you're criticizing my producer, Bill, for being stupid or smart or having bad taste, fine. That's one thing. It doesn't mean you're saying anything about the fact that he's a Methodist. My gosh, what have we become? Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I want to tell you about Dinesh D'Souza's latest film. It's called Trump Card, an expose of the socialism, corruption, and gangsterism that defines the modern Democratic Party. This film reveals what's unique about modern socialism, why it's evil, who's behind it, how we can work with President Trump to stop it. Pre-order your DVD and video on demand now at watchtrumpcard.com. That's watchtrumpcard.com. This is one of the greatest things that I have seen come out of the federal government. And you may recall I mentioned that this could be the case some 4 months ago. With all these institutions of higher learning, all these colleges and universities, with the notable exception of Hillsdale, perhaps a few others, but not many, that were falling all over themselves and genuflecting to say that they were going to examine their and take on their institutional racism, all these confessions of institutional racism. And you, of course, many of you in the audience, you shared similar emails from your own schools, particularly private and charter schools, some public at the elementary and secondary level. I said, well, you know, my advice is you shouldn't send your student to a school that's racist, and that they better be careful because these public admissions of their racism are going to at some point be taken seriously by either the Department of Education or the Department of Justice, and they could subject themselves to possibly losing federal funding. Because under various civil rights and education civil rights amendments, federal money cannot go to institutions that discriminate. And all these institutions are saying, yes, we have been racist, and yes, we are going to examine our institutional racism. Well, as Paul Mierengoff reports, Princeton University's president, Christopher Eisgruber, issued a letter. He was one of these presidents, in which he admitted that the institution he has run for the last 7 years was plagued by systemic racism. One of them is that it confesses to a violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which provides that no person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination. Those who attend a systematically racist college are by definition subjected to discrimination by the college. No? Great. So the U.S. Department of Education is now on the case. 2 days ago, the Department of Education sent a letter to the president of Princeton, and the letter informs him that the department is opening an investigation into racism at Princeton. An investigation that could have important adverse financial consequences for the university. The letter includes probing requests for additional information, and it informs President Eisgruber that he will be called on to answer questions under oath about Princeton's racism. This is one of the greatest things. I didn't think the Department of Education had this in them. The department's letter begins by reminding Eisgruber that Princeton has received more than $75 million in federal aid over the last 7 years during his tenure as president, and that as a condition of receiving that aid, the university has certified that it complies with Title VI non-discrimination requirements. In addition, Princeton represents to the public, including students and parents, in all its literature, that it doesn't discriminate on the basis of race. And then the letter notes the contradiction between Princeton's representation that it doesn't discriminate and the president of Princeton's confession that the institution is systematically racist. Based on the contradiction, the department tells President Eisgruber that Princeton's representations may have been false. Were you lying to the public? Were you lying to the federal government to obtain this $75 million? It also expresses concern that Princeton, quote, perhaps knew or should have known these assurances were false at the time they were made. So consequently, the Department of Education's letter says it's opening an investigation that could lead to an action to recover the funds from Princeton. This is going to be an awfully costly thing for the schools. It could also lead to a fine if Princeton is found to have made substantial misrepresentations about the nature of educational programs. The question will be, naturally, was President Eisgruber lying then and for the past 7 years, or is he lying now? Which one is it? But you can't declare non-discrimination at the same time that you are declaring systemic racism. The two don't work. They don't go together. The document request in the department's letter makes for enjoyable reading. God bless these guys. Among other things, Princeton is asked to produce all records relating to Princeton's systemic and or embedded racism, terms used in President Eisgruber's open letter, the one that confessed to systemic or embedded racism. The time frame of the request is from 2013 to the present, which is Eisgruber's tenure, time as president at Princeton. The department is requesting a spreadsheet identifying each person who has, on the ground of race, color, natural origin, been excluded from participation in, been denied the benefits of, or been subject to discrimination under any program or activity receiving financial assistance as a result of Princeton's racism or damage referenced in the president's letter. And the spreadsheet, it says, has to identify each such person, provide his or her last known address, and specify his or her damage, if known. Next, the department's letter asks Princeton to produce Eisgruber for a transcribed interview under oath within 28 days. It also makes the same request for a designated corporate representative with knowledge regarding the bases and accuracy of Princeton's assurances regarding compliance with Title VI for the last 7 years. I can't wait for these transcribed interviews to become publicly available. I cannot wait. You want to hear the first question Princeton is asked by the department? It's this. The president's letter admits racism and the damage it does to people of color persists at Princeton, and racist assumptions remain embedded in structures of the university itself. That's all in quotes, quoting President Eisgruber. Here's the question. Do these admissions mean Princeton's non-discrimination and equal opportunity assurances and representations to the department and to students, parents, and consumers in the market for education have been false and misleading? If not, why not? Great question. Second question. How many individuals were on the ground of race, color, or national origin excluded from participation in, denied benefits of, or subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance by Princeton University? Is this number evidence of systemic or embedded racism? Finally, the department asks for the number of public non-discrimination and equal opportunity representations Princeton has made, measured by website visits between January 2015 and the present. This is great, and I hope they don't just do it with private and public universities. I hope they do it with private and public schools. You bet. If a school is admitting to institutional racism, I want to know about it, and I don't want federal dollars going to it. I'll tell you about Princeton's response when we come back. For all your video and social media conferencing needs, SquadPod is the best tool that I can recommend. It's a private communication and collaboration tool with all the features you need that respects and listens to you and your team. Collaborate with all of them. Chat, share files, video conference privately. Screen sharing. It's fabulous with a lot of great features. There may be other companies out there. None of them have the features that SquadPod have or can make the guarantees that SquadPod makes. No tracking or monitoring of your conversations, none of your information used or sold for machine learning, no use of third parties at all. Respect totally for free speech and your privacy. Housed right here in America, owned and operated in America. In fact, in Arizona. Check them out at squadpod.com/Seth. I was telling you before the break, public schools, private schools, foundations, nonprofits, all of them that went through this self-flagellation of declaring their institutional racism, I said back then they better watch out because they receive donations and contributions and subvention from the federal and state governments based on their declarations of non-racism, of engaging based on their guarantees of complying with federal civil rights law, whether it's Title VII or Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and that these declarations and professions of institutional racism could be a real problem, because they have said that they do not discriminate and they have taken money based on their non-discriminatory claims. Well, the Department of Education has rolled up their sleeves and they're getting down to it with Princeton. And they have sent a letter to the president of Princeton asking him, in effect, was he lying for the last 7 years in declaring Princeton to being an institution that respects civil rights? Or is he lying now when he is professing the school's problematic institutional racism? It was a great letter. And as Paul Marengoff reports, Princeton's president, Christopher Eisgruber, has responded. Princeton issued a statement yesterday saying, quote, "The letter was the department's reaction to President Eisgruber's update to the university community, outlining steps taken to address systemic racism at Princeton and beyond. Princeton has long been committed to creating and maintaining a community where all can thrive and stands by its representations to the department and the public that it complies with all laws and regulations governing equal opportunity, non-discrimination, and harassment. This work is core to the university's teaching and research. The university also stands by its statements about the prevalence of systemic racism." I don't know how you can do both. "And our commitment to reckon with its continued effects, including the racial injustice and race-based inequities that persist throughout American society. The university will respond to the Department of Education's letter in due course. It is unfortunate," Princeton says, "that the department appears to believe that grappling honestly with the nation's history and the current effects of systemic racism runs afoul of existing law. The university disagrees and looks forward to furthering its educational mission by explaining why its statements and actions are consistent with the law and the highest ideals and aspirations of this country." As Paul puts it, in effect, Princeton's response amounts to asking, what's a poor university president to do? Princeton is trapped in a systemically racist country. If it does nothing to combat the manifestations of this problem, students will suffer. If it faces up to the problem, the education department will harass it. Here is one thing poor President Eisgruber could have done. If racism really is embedded at Princeton, he could have undertaken the initiative he's announced now, back in 2013 when he took over charge of the university. In other words, he could have engaged in his quote-unquote honest grappling with racism at Princeton 7 years ago instead of waiting for protests to reach fever pitch. Here's another. Instead of repeatedly telling the government and others that Princeton doesn't discriminate, he could have said, as he did in his recent letter, that racism is embedded at Princeton and is causing damage there. He could then have enumerated the measures, if any, that Princeton was taking. This would have enabled the government to decide, based on Princeton's presumably honest assessment of the situation, whether the university was in fact meeting its legal obligations. But Princeton did neither of these things. Princeton's going to have a hard time threading the needle between Eisgruber's admissions of systemic, embedded, and damaging racism at the university on the one hand and its legal obligation to not discriminate on the other. It's not a promising beginning. I love this story. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. If you don't take Balance of Nature right now, I want you to consider taking it. It is a fabulous product that not only do I take, but that friends of mine take, that family members of mine take. We take it every single day, and in so doing, we get tens of thousands of vital nutrients from whole food, fruits, plants, and vegetables, mangoes, apples, bananas, blueberries, carrots, spinach. We get energy. We get boosted immunity. We get improved health. This is powerful, robust stuff. You take it just once a day, and they have a great deal where they're offering free shipping and 35% off any new preferred order of their fruits and veggies. That's what I take. Give them a call at 800-246-8751. Or go to balanceofnature.com and make sure to use discount code BALANCE. Energize yourself, improve your health, boost your immunity naturally with the fruits and vegetables of Balance of Nature. This is huge breaking news, folks, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has passed away. Repeat that, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg, has passed away today at the age of 87. Aside from the obvious condolences we want to extend to her friends and family, this is going to have a huge reflection and a huge impact on this upcoming election. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Boy, when you thought this year could not be any more stressful or take any more hits, It did. And there, of course, as you know, have been strong debates forwarded by Democrats and Republicans about whether judicial nominations should even happen in a presidential election year. And we'll go through that in just a moment. Of course, why is this important? I was actually interviewed the other day, Sunday. It was a Sunday interview. On the Canadian with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and they asked me how much judicial nominations play in the presidential election and in the motivation of the right. And I said, well, I think conservatives do take it very, very seriously because they recognize what Alexis de Tocqueville wrote about long ago in the 19th century in his book Democracy in America, where he said there is hardly any political question in the United States that does not turn in to a judicial question. It's not what the judiciary was meant for. It's quite clearly not what it was meant for when you read Hamilton, particularly in the Federalist Papers, Federalist number 78, to be precise, to be specific. But that is what has happened. I then was quick to point out and say, however, do understand this is not just a concern of conservatives. If you think the left and liberals don't take this issue equally seriously, I give you the Brett Kavanaugh nomination and the circus that surrounded that. I said the difference between the conservatives and the liberals on this question is that we don't try and personally destroy nominees and their families in real time, in print, on live television, or invoke innuendo and lies about them on ancillary news shows or in the hearings. We do not. You look at the way our Judiciary Committee members handle Democratic nominees to the Supreme Court, and you look at the way Democrats handle Republican nominees to the Supreme Court. It's not night and day. It's as if you're looking at two different Judiciary Committee hearing bodies. It's as if in one case you're looking at the U.S. Senate when it's a Democratic nominee, and at one case when you're looking at Thunderdome when it's a Republican nominee. It's not accurate exactly to say that it all started with Robert Bork in 1986 and Ted Kennedy's great slanders against Robert Bork, saying that Robert Bork's America is America of segregated lunch counters. It's just that that was the worst of it when television and cable news was beginning, like CNN, to have much more of an impact. There were controversial Supreme Court nominations in the past. Nixon got Harry Blackmun on the court, the ultimate author of Roe v. Wade, after the Senate declined to approve two previous nominees Nixon had put up. Abe Fortas's nomination was hugely controversial in the Lyndon Johnson administration. And indeed, going all the way back to John Jay, there has been a history of controversial nominations that looked like something close to political blood sport. But what Kennedy did was he took that blood sport with Robert Bork and put it on speed so that you don't know anymore whether it's Bork or whether it's Thomas or whether it's Kavanaugh, what kind of nominee a Republican can send up, a Republican president can send up to the Senate Judiciary Committee, that they won't go absolutely for the jugular on. You don't know. And the reason I say that is, yes, Robert Bork was conservative, but he was also one of the most respected legal scholars in the country. Yes, Clarence Thomas was conservative, but he had also already passed Senate confirmation in becoming the head of things like the Civil Rights Commission. And Brett Kavanaugh was what one, by any fair estimation and measurement, would conclude was not a conservative in the tradition of Clarence Thomas or Robert Bork. He was considered a much more, I hate to use the word, but that's the word we're given to understand, a much more moderate kind of Republican nominee to the Supreme Court. But the left treated it as blood sport. They treated it as Thunderdome. Kamala Harris dropped innuendos on him. 60 Minutes. Do you remember Michael Avenatti? Do you remember how badly his family was dragged through the mud over what turned out to have no evidence whatsoever? So, as I said, the question will become, is this a hearing that we're going to do and conduct before this presidential campaign on November 3rd? Most assuredly, it is not. There is not time for this process to take hold. But will it be on the minds and will it now be a part of campaign rhetoric? You bet. And I'll say something about that when we come back as well. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. If you're thinking about or planning on selling your home, you want to call James Wexler of JMG Real Estate. He's the only agent I would call if I needed to sell my home. You don't want to give it your house away or leave any money on the table. And with James, you won't, because he guarantees to sell your home at market value or pay the difference. He can also make you an upfront guaranteed offer within 24 hours for maximum convenience to you. Of course, no risk to you. James will let you out of your contract at any time. I know people who have already heard my promotion of James, who have begun working with him. I have friends who have sold their homes through James. He is great, and he is a friend. He sells more homes, over $500,000, than any other agent in Phoenix and Scottsdale. Give James Wexler a call at 480-386-0711 or visit him online at jameswexler.com. That's jameswexler.com. I have Bill with a good angle, it looks like, on the Princeton story. And, Bill, if I can ask you to hold, because this is a short segment, I will get to you at the top of the next hour. Kristen is in Queen Creek with something I think we can fit right in here. Hi, Kristen.
Hello, Seth. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I want to say very quickly that last week, our Queen Creek rally, we had instantly over 40 people. It was fabulous.
Oh, wonderful.
Today at 5:30, corner of Victoria and Ellsworth Loop, again, we're going to have a pop-up Trump rally. Bring your flags, bring your children, bring your signs, and support our president. We need to let everyone know we are no longer the silent majority.
That's right. That's right, Kristen. Thank you. At the corner of Victoria and Ellsworth Loop in Queen Creek at 5:30 today, a pop-up rally on behalf of President Trump, on behalf of the country, really. Right, Kristen?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Really appreciate
it.
You betcha.
Thank you for being there.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
More importantly, thank you for being there. These things do matter. I was driving home the other day, and I don't know if it was a quote-unquote pop-up rally or not, but I saw a huge, huge collection of people. I wouldn't even know how many to count. Clearly over 100 on the corner of 44th and Camelback, with signs supporting the president, supporting the police, asking people to honk. It's a good, important thing. You know, politics used to be that way, fun and energetic, and it should be again. 602-508-0960, your hour, the next hour.